Hello and welcome to Pittsburgh Liberation Radio. This is your host, Nick, and I'm here with my comrade, Ty, who's a leading organizer here in Pittsburgh PSL, Party for Socialism and Liberation. So we thought we would get together to do an episode tonight, more of a conversational episode, because obviously there is an ongoing genocide in Gaza still, and there's a lot of events that are going on in the region broadly, as a response to this genocide by anti-imperialist forces in the region, such as Hezbollah, Ansar Allah, various groups across Syria, Iraq, Iran. So we wanted to get together tonight to have a theoretical conversation on concepts like imperialism, self-determination, and how we as anti-imperialist organizers within the U.S. should really be grounding ourselves in these concepts and orienting ourselves with respect to, you know, our principles, our values, and what the world we want to see be, but still remaining grounded, I think, in the concrete reality, trying to assess forces concretely on the ground and understanding the moment that we're in, right? So as I said, the Gaza genocide goes on unabated at this point by Israel, with the full backing of the U.S. We're still shipping mountains of weapons, bombs every day, resisting international pressure to do anything about it. And as such, again, forces opposed to this in the region are responding, right? Hezbollah has been responding from the beginning, and that's just one example. Now, recently, three U.S. soldiers were killed in a strike on a U.S. airbase in Jordan. The U.S. responded by launching on the order of 85 strikes, and I believe counting at this point, in targets in Iraq and Syria. The justification for this response is, of course, that the targets were linked to Iranian-backed proxies across the region. And Ty, you and I were talking at the beginning that, like, while the U.S. may not necessarily want to see a regional war, a huge conflagration with Iran, given its position in the world, its status essentially as the unipolar imperialist hegemon, it's kind of in a position that is forced to escalate regardless of what it wants to see happen, because people are actually fighting back against its role in the region, both, you know, historically and contemporaneously, right? So to me, this is just one example that we can pull from, like, the last 4 months, or really the last, I don't know how many decades, but it brings into sharp focus why we take the position that we do in terms of an anti-imperialist politics. And we fight back so uncompromisingly against things like U.S.-led demonization campaigns against a certain government, right?
Yeah, I mean, and before even I start, let's be clear, right? The blood of these three soldiers, three working-class black people, are on Biden's hands. Like any U.S. soldier that's stationed in the Middle East right now, they are put in harm's way for the sake of enabling genocide against the people of Palestine. So all the troops should be coming home. Now, as you stated, right, the forces that are fighting, that are resisting against the U.S. imperialism in the region, whether they are in Yemen, Iraq, Lebanon, or anywhere else, the corporate media, the Western corporate media, and of course the U.S. government, right, portrays them as Iranian proxies for their imperialist propaganda. But that's absolutely not the case, right? These are forces that are organic, indigenous popular movements, and they are resisting against the U.S. imperialist presence in the region, against the ongoing genocide in Palestine, which is basically manufactured by the U.S. government, U.K. and other Western governments. So we do need to sort of push back on that narrative, right, which really is intentional, because out of this, the U.S. and the media wants to sort of continue building on the demonization campaign against Iran, which obviously is a local, like in West Asia or Middle East, an important power. It has relations with the states in the region. It stands with Palestine. But I do want to quote recent, like, you know, after U.S. bombed these sites, 85 of them in Syria and Iraq. One of the members of the Iraqi parliament, the name is Mustafa Sanad, said this. It's really important to sort of listen to Iraqis themselves on this, especially this is a member of the Iraqi parliament. So he said, I'm quoting, whenever news from the White House claims that U.S. airstrikes are directed against Iranian-backed armed factions that targeted U.S. bases in the region and that these airstrikes are effective, be sure that they are fake news. So, and then continues, all of the strikes are aimed at Iraqi national forces associated with the Popular Mobilization Forces, an official government entity. And then he does go on to say these strikes have no negative impact on the resistance factions, but rather on the Iraqi people who hold the Popular Mobilization Forces in high regard. Drone attacks against U.S. bases continue. U.S. airstrikes are ineffective at deterring them. So this is important, right? This is an Iraqi parliament member that's outright rejecting this sort of a narrative that also sort of wipes off any agency that people who, when faced with an imperialist oppression, as if they cannot really independently fight against it, then they have to be some puppets of some other sort of force. That's, of course, imperialist thinking, right? Because that's what the U.S. empire, how it operates. It does have client regime states where, keeping the people under those states aside, the ruling class of those client states are sort of, obviously they care about their own interests, but they're also beholden to the bully in the picture, the U.S. empire. This is absolutely not the case when it comes to these forces in Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Lebanon that are fighting against the U.S. imperialism. They are anti-imperialist forces. They play a big role, especially, I mean, think about what the Yemeni forces are doing, right? Sort of putting their bodies on the line directly to stop the genocide. Iraq, Syria under U.S. occupation, right, with these bases. So those forces are also driving towards the liberation of their own country from U.S. imperialism.
Yeah, you touched on a lot of things that I think are very important. But one thing you said in particular that I just want to reiterate is that mention of agency. And to me, it's always just profoundly racist to take away that agency from these folks in different, you know, very distinct geographies that have their own legitimate grievances with U.S. imperialism and the Zionist project in particular. I mean, you mentioned Ansar Allah and the Yemeni people broadly. I mean, they are just not that far removed from a genocidal onslaught that was backed by the U.S. So they have very good reason to fight against the U.S., the U.K., and what they rightfully see as a arm of U.S. colonialism and imperialism in Israel, the Zionist entity, right? And then, for that matter, we can add Hezbollah to that equation. I mean, just think about why Hezbollah even exists. Hezbollah arose as a result of the Israeli invasion to dislodge the PLO into southern Lebanon in the 1980s, right? I mean, they are an organic resistance force, to your point. So again, just to dismiss all of these groups as, oh, like some sinister force is coming in from, you know, the outside and driving all this, you know, anti-US, anti-imperialist, anti-Israel sentiment. I mean, again, just dismisses like the concrete historical facts that would give rise to the impetus for these people to fight back. And again, we're only limiting it to the past 30 or 40 years. I mean, we could go into a conversation about British and French and subsequently U.S. colonialism in the region, you know, over the past 100 and 150 years. But I don't think we have time for that today.
Yeah. I think, I mean, the region, right, has so many movements that are rooted in the anti-colonial sort of resistance that predates, obviously, like that goes back more than 100 years ago. But I think, Nick, given this sort of tension and given this conflict and the demonization of these forces and countries in that region, I'm feeling like it will be important to kind of visit or iterate, elaborate as sort of organizers, anti-imperialist organizers in the heart of the U.S. empire, right, the core imperial center. I think it would be good if we could kind of take a few minutes to elaborate what are our basic principles of operation in terms of the anti-imperialist and anti-war movement. And they're not many. And maybe we could dive into what we mean by some of these principles in detail. But one of the things that we right off the bat, right, say when we're organizing is that we unconditionally oppose all forms of U.S. or NATO intervention, bombing, sanctions, anywhere, right? The U.S. intervention, the U.S. imperialist interventions have never brought anything that was to the benefit of the people. The only thing that they brought is destruction, barbaric violence, plunder of whatever country that they targeted, of their resources, penetration into their markets, and exploiting the resources and the working people of whatever the country that was targeted, right? I mean, just imagine Iraq, there being more than 2 million people killed, right, murdered. Obviously, the U.S. imperialists, like any other intervention, have never had any humanitarian concerns. They seek profit, they seek control, and we will unconditionally oppose any form of their intervention anywhere. And this includes sanctions, right? Sanctions is outright a clear form of war, because at times sanctions kill more people than bombs or military operations. So on that principle, our side is clear. Our side is always, always the side against imperialism and for the oppressed people. Now, second one, we do respect the right to self-determination of oppressed people and their sovereignty when they're facing imperialist aggression. That principle means the right of self-determination means that only that nation itself has the right to determine its destiny, that no other force has the right to forcibly interfere in the life of that nation. No imperialist power has the right to intervene in the internal affairs of any nation. And people have that right to figure out, to decide what their future is, what kind of government they want to be building without any imperialist intervention. And surely, right, as people in the belly of the empire, we do have a huge responsibility to sort of wage that anti-imperial struggle so that the defeat on the empire translates into all these people that are facing that imperialist oppression being able to build their own future without any foreign intervention. I'll take a pause here. I do have one more principle, but I do want to sort of let you in case you have some addition or any comments to make on these two that I've just gone over. Nick.
No, I mean, I think I want to get into self-determination definitionally in a little bit more detail after we get through this point of unity. But just to even further drive home this categorical opposition to NATO and U.S. interventionism. I mean, there's almost too many examples to count of like concrete evidence as to why we would take the position that we do. I mean, look at Libya. You mentioned sanctions in Iraq. I mean, if we look in the interwar period, right, we put sanctions on Iraq, which killed 500,000 children due to hunger and starvation. And Madeleine Albright, I believe, said right. that the price we think is worth it, was her quote. I mean, and honestly, look at what's going on in Russia and Ukraine. There have been so many Ukrainian men that have been basically thrown into the meat grinder, all for U.S. and Western imperialist interests to, quote unquote, weaken Russia. They don't care about Ukrainian sovereignty as cynically as they throw that around. The fact of the matter is this whole situation could have been resolved a long time ago, barring U.S. and European, Western European interference into Ukraine. And now we're seeing the results of that.
Yeah, I mean, and if they cared about the Ukrainian sovereignty, right, let's remember in 2014, it was the U.S. That basically overthrew a democratically elected government, albeit corrupt and whatever its problems, right? It was the U.S. that overthrew that government and through the also help of outright neo-Nazi forces that they funded armed, brought in this new Ukrainian regime in place, right? That was beholden to the U.S. interests. So.
And why? I mean, there's a plethora of reasons, and I think we'll get into imperialist domination and what that actually looks like concretely in terms of institutions. But as I understand it, it was because they had a president, Yanukovych, a government, right, who wasn't, I mean, he was no like people's hero or anything like that, but he was kind of playing center field between Russia and, you know, the West, we'll call it, right? Yeah. And I think at that time, he was looking for financing loans, right, to spur economic growth, do some development in the country. And he obviously approached the West and the International Monetary Fund and was considering rejecting those. And in fact, did reject terms, I believe, that the IMF was putting forward, and then approached Russia, right? Because Russia has its own kind of center of finance. And that was too much to bear for economic ties to deepen between Ukraine and Russia. Again, neighbor states, right? Where it would like logically make sense, where some level of cooperation would make, you know, would make sense. I don't want to get too far into this, but like the US is concerned about this halfway around the world, right? And then to bring it back to the conversation on the anti-imperialist forces in West Asia right now, I mean, again, when we go back to agency, is it really that hard for people? I mean, at a really basic level, is it really that hard for people to imagine that people in this region that, again, have been dominated by, you know, Western imperialism, Western forces, that they would somehow decide to work together because they have common interests based on a shared history, based on a common geography, based on shared cultural values, I would think, at some level? I mean, is it really that hard to think that people would work together to fight for a common cause, like making that choice on their own? And again, I'm not speaking theoretically here, but just very, very concretely.
Yeah, the observance. And I mean, obviously, there's never a case where oppression doesn't breed resistance back, and people at some point resist back and fight back. But going back to the principles, let me just recap, right? We said, number one, we oppose all U.S. NATO intervention in whatever form they come, bombing, sanctions, anywhere and unconditionally. We stand with the people, the oppressed people, and against imperialism. Second is we respect the right to self-determination of oppressed nations and their sovereignty against when facing imperialism. The third one, and I mean, this is important, right? We reject in any form participation in the war makers' demonization campaigns in any shape or form. Because when the war machine, the U.S. war machine, before they unleash any war, right, the tactic is the warmongers start sort of, and the corporate media portray the leader of the targeted nation or the movement as just pure devil. And, you know, they repeat some of these also news stories, horror stories that actually are not true. And they're outright fabrications. Like, you can all relate to that, to some of these claims following the October 7, all of those have been debunked, but, you know, they served a purpose at the time. And all these fabrications are also sort of accompanied by a large dose of racism, right? So that the people in the U.S. can actually get behind this yet another war that the U.S. is waging. And, I mean, there's a reason, like the coalition that we also work with, right, the ANSWER coalition, it stands for Act Now to Stop War and End Racism, because the two, like the notion of waging a war needs racism as one of its propaganda tools. So our campaigns, our slogans, our movement cannot add even an ounce of weight to that demonization campaign, right? Our slogans and key message has to be clear, has to counter that demonization and not participate in it. I mean, look at this recent Thomas Friedman quote in the New York Times, right? When this recent sort of Iraqi attack and the response to Iraqi men and all that by the U.S. I mean, this is what he's saying. So the title, Understanding the Middle East Through the Animal Kingdom. So, and I'm from the Middle East, I guess we don't exist as humans. Is there a better description of Lebanon, Yemen, Syria, and Iraq today? They're the caterpillars. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Force, that's the Iranian force, is the wasp. Houthis, Hezbollah, Hamas, Hatib, Hezbollah are the eggs that hatch inside the host. Lebanon, Yemen, Syria, and Iraq, and eat it from the inside out. So this is, if this is not outright blatant racism, I mean, I have no words. But that's how, right, their mind is, their sort of propaganda mind is working in order to sort of justify the U.S. actually bombing 85 sites in Syria and Iraq, both still are technically countries that are under U.S. occupation.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, obviously that's disgusting racism. And this is a guy that's won a Pulitzer. Like, this is the kind of rhetoric and, I guess, cultural output that the imperialist America produces right now. And we celebrate this guy. I mean, it's disgusting beyond words. And like, I almost feel like weird even stating it after this, because obviously I support anybody in their fight against that racist vitriol and, again, bombing campaigns. But I think it's important for us to emphasize that just because we're supporting a nation or a group's fight against U.S. imperialism doesn't necessarily that we're, you know, in complete or even partial ideological alignment with them necessarily, but we do support their right to fight back and open up the space for, you know, new movements free of U.S. interference to be birthed, right? But again, like, that doesn't exist right now in the era of U.S. imperialism, because the U.S. is a globe-spanning empire. And again, it occupies most of the world with almost 900 military bases. Again, foreign occupying military bases, right? And to your point about putting people in harm's way, I mean, eventually that occupation is going to breed resistance to it. And you're putting, again, predominantly working class people in the armed forces in the line of fire for the interests of a small ruling elite. But again, just to make the point that, like, just because we fight back against these demonization campaigns, this racism, again, doesn't mean there's ideological complete alignment or anything, but we need to get this primary contradiction of U.S. imperialism resolved and then see what comes. But that's what we're dealing with at the moment.
And that's really what the principle of defending a people's right to self-determination really means in that respect, right? Because we're in the heart of an empire that's ruled by the most vicious barbaric ruling class that has brought in destruction and immense suffering like never seen. And obviously our priority is defeating that class and ending that imperialist power, because when that ends, then all these other nations that are actually struggling, that are facing this imperialist aggression, right, will have the ability without that intervention to be able to determine their future, whatever they want, however they want to build their nation, their countries, their government. That's basically up to them, right? Again, our main focus is fighting the U.S. empire from within.
And that's our responsibility, because this is the government that we pay taxes to. It's the government that ostensibly represents us. Obviously, it doesn't. It's not reflective of the people at all. But again, on paper, that's what it's supposed to be. So again, this is where we live. This is what we're responsible for fighting. I mean, it doesn't do us any good to sit here and fall into the demonization campaign traps and manufacturing of consent or the inventing of reality, whatever you like to say, to justify another U.S.-led war.
And one other thing maybe we could just sort of briefly discuss is, I don't think we need to really go into much detail, but when we talk about the right to self-determination, it always has to have a context, because it's also a slippery slope if we don't have a concrete analysis of the concrete situation, because especially post-World War II, U.S. being the main imperial power that dominates the rest of the imperialist power, so there's no sort of inter-imperialist conflict like it was in World War I, and also the sort of collapse of the Soviet Union, which was a disaster for the working class all over the world, right? The notion of the right to self-determination, when used out of context, is also one that sort of can be utilized by the imperialist powers to sort of engage in color revolutions or regime change operations, right?
Yeah.
When we see people on the streets anywhere in the world, when we look at an opposition movement, we can't just unconditionally right away give or sort of support this as a revolution, right? We have to have certain questions that we ask and answer, like, what is the political character of that movement? Does it have an anti-capitalist character? Is it a working class movement? Does it represent, if we were to become victorious, an expansion of the country's independence, or does it promote its submission to the imperialist powers, multinational corporations, right? Because the US imperialists are also asking all these types of questions. And then based on that answer, right, they are deciding whether to sort of go all out support or not. So this is important that we have this critical view. Otherwise, like if you think, imagine somebody outside the US looking at, let's say, what happened in January 6th, 2 years ago, just because there are people on the streets and some of it might have also have legitimate economic concerns, but without really understanding the class character of what that movement is about, you might, well, okay, I'm with them, right?
Like a petty bourgeois revolution, like is that really what we want to line up behind?
Right, so you would be ending up lining up behind some sort of a ultra-right reactionary Trump movement, right? Mm-hmm. So that's obviously not what we're saying. It's always has a context, the right to self-determination of a nation when facing an imperialist oppressor. And you know, that's really what we need to be careful about.
A pretty good litmus test to that point, at least for me. And again, you still have to do the investigation. You still have to analyze the conditions, the class character of all this. But my immediate check would be, what is the US media saying about a given movement? If it's in support of it, it's probably been astroturfed or co-opted or it's just been fake and manufactured. I mean, again, look into it, but this is a good initial test. If the US is demonizing it, then it's probably a reason to investigate it further exactly. As it's something possibly to critically support.
Yeah, I mean, and also let's while at it maybe point out this obvious hypocrisy, right? Like, say an arch reactionary regime like Saudi Arabia, which gets like all the material and moral support from the US, which, right, has basically obviously waged a genocidal war against the people of Yemen, but also it's like, I think it would be fair to say that it's the most oppressive regime you can actually define in the world. And that never seems to be a concern for either the US ruling class, which because it's basically one of their proxies, I wouldn't want to call it allies, the client state, but also for the liberals, right, who otherwise fall for this demonization campaign on other, you know, countries and governments that are under US imperialist crosshair, Saudi Arabia doesn't ever get on their radar.
No, because it's not talked about. I mean, one example that I think we should talk about concretely because it's relevant to the recent history of the region, and also when we talk about the key anti-imperialist forces and how they work together, is Syria. I mean, Syria was subject to a almost decade-long, if not longer, dirty war led by the forces of imperialism. So can we talk about that a little bit? I mean, can we talk about why, how that analysis of a given movement comes into play and how we would actually apply a concept like right to self-determination to a situation in the nuanced way that you described?
Yeah. I mean, Syria is a good example of some sort of an actual group of people who had legitimate concerns, ironically, also due to this neoliberal policies that was forced on the Syrian government. And the Syrian government, you know, still it's a capitalist national bourgeois government that wanted to not be isolated and be sort of part of the, to a certain extent, the you know, economy, international economy, having implemented these policies that took away some of the social economic benefits from like farmers and workers. So a movement that started as legitimate demands, but then it was quickly hijacked and dominated, right, by these groups, ultra-reactionary Islamist groups that are, they were funded by NATO and the local proxies, whether it's Qatar, Saudi Arabia, or Turkey. And then on the other side, the Syrian government had significant sectors of the population which supported it, including the Communist Party. So how do you determine what's the right position to take? First, I mean, obviously, as we kept on saying, despite that fake rhetoric of freedom, democracy, and human rights, that at the time also, the U.S. was and the corporate media was talking about, that intervention, the only objective of it was for the domination of this strategically decisive and oil-rich nation. And they wanted to overthrow the government in Syria, which again, right, was maintaining an independent foreign policy. And at times also, I mean, this is crucial that it was assisting resistance movements such as in Palestine. And if the imperialists had succeeded in their objective to overthrow Syria, that would have been not only a disaster for most of the peoples in Syria, as the Syria as a sort of a unitary state would have been dismembered, balkanized, and probably there would have been three states that came out of it on Sunni, Shiite, and maybe a Kurdish one, that all would have been beholden to the interests of the U.S. empire. They would have probably most likely or almost certainly be ultra-reactionary governments. And then that would also mean a big blow to these movements in the region, resistance movements. And then it would have enabled the U.S. To be able to go after Iran at that time. So in that case, right, once that analysis was sort of made and it was clear that that initial genuine popular movement was hijacked, because at the time, at the earliest stages, there was this opposition movement which stood on three principles, right? No to violence, no to sectarianism, and no to foreign intervention. That group, I think they were called National Coordination Committees. They were like right away pushed aside, right? And then this, as I said, the U.S. and the local reactionary governments backed terror groups more or less took over the opposition movement. So in that case, our position was clear, right? We did sort of stand for the Syrian nations and their governments' right to liberate their country from the U.S.-backed regime change operation. And our slogan was simply U.S. Hands of Syria. That was it. I mean, folks who are interested in also what the Communist Party in Syria at the time was writing, it's really important to sort of take a look at that too, because they also very easily, early on, understood the nature of the way this movement was going, and then through their support behind the Syrian government, as they saw that if the Syrian national and like the state were dismembered, it would have been a disaster for majority of the people and the region as well. Does this make like then that we did say hands of Syria and not add to the demonization campaign make us ideologically aligned with Ba'athist ideology, which, I mean, if you go into its roots, it's ultimately an anti-colonial ideology. Obviously, it's not what it is, how it started, things change. But it was an anti-colonial ideology against the French domination. But does that make us Ba'athists? Absolutely not, right? We just, as we keep saying, have the duty to defend a nation's right to self-determination when facing an imperialist aggression.
Well, and I think that initial formation of the movement is, if we extrapolated this out, I don't like to do this very much, right? Because we still have to live in the world that we're living in. But like I mentioned earlier, that we're hoping that in the absence of U.S. imperialism, space opens up for these movements to take off and actually develop in a very positive way, right? Again, if you see a coalition forming like that with, you know, no to violence, anti-imperialist, right? I mean, you could see a coalition like that, again, in the absence of, I mean, again, this was Saudi and U.S. led funding of the worst reactionary groups in the region, yeah, right? Coming in and slaughtering and villages.
Qatar and Turkey on the other side.
Absolutely,
as well.
Yeah, right.
Qatar, Saudis, and Turkey.
Right. But in the absence of those imperialist forces, can that coalition actually get enough of a mass movement together? I mean, maybe they, you know, make a change to the governing structure, or maybe they just are able to articulate the demands in such a way and demonstrate enough force that they can demonstrate enough presence that they can actually, again, force changes upon their government. I don't know. Again, I don't want to get into speculating about what could happen. But again, that is what we conceive of when we say, like, let's get rid of this primary contradiction of U.S. imperialism, such that like these genuine grassroots popular movements can actually flourish and develop on their own terms.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, and you know, another example of this, and I think why people have to understand the full connections are that, you know, you mentioned Syria's role in the resistance forces, right? And how that interplays with the Palestinian struggle itself, right? I mean, we're talking about an area of land that is not controlled by U.S. imperialism and Zionism, right? That can actually connect these forces such that they can actually meet and coordinate. Again, all doing it under the power of their own agency, et cetera, et cetera. But if Syria had been Balkanized, and I think that's a good term that you used, if Syria had been Balkanized, I mean, you're talking about basically Palestine, Lebanon being cut off from a lot of these other groups, right? Like the forces in Iraq that are sympathetic, the forces in Iran that are sympathetic. So it gets tough to say that, like, you support Palestine, but you don't support every other group fighting against, you know, Zionism, which again, for the Palestinians, is the contradiction that they have to resolve for their own survival at this point in time.
Right. And I mean, one thing, Syria is still technically northern part of Syria is under U.S. occupation.
Right? Absolutely.
There are still more than 2,500 U.S. forces stationed there in various bases. And also 80% of Syria's oil is literally plundered by the U.S. as we speak, right?
Yeah.
Because northern part of Syria is the more sort of oil-rich region. And that's also why, obviously, U.S. it will take an actual resistance and a fight for the U.S. to relinquish that, right? They would have to be defeated by a resistance. And that's also sort of the same thing in Iraq, right? These genuine anti-imperialist movements are not only, again, standing in absolute solidarity against the situation, the genocide in Palestine, and doing what they can to stop it, but they also, it's a group in the movement in Iraq, right? It's also a movement for liberating Iraq itself from U.S. occupation.
Absolutely. Do we want to move on to imperialism?
Yeah, I think it's important because we did talk about the right of the nations, the right to self-determination against imperialism. Then maybe it's important that we kind of elaborate what we mean by imperialism.
Yeah, we've thrown it around quite a lot tonight. And, you know, I think we come up in their various movements and our political organizing, we come across a lot of people throwing that term around, right? One thing that I think we would caution against, and I think we can do that a little bit here, is rigidly applying a definition of imperialism that was set in 1916. I mean, I'm obviously referencing Lenin here. And while Lenin's core analysis undoubtedly remains true and a bedrock, I think, of our understanding, as with any piece of theory, I think it's so important for us to update it and revise it so that it's applicable within a contemporary context, right? Like, you cannot just rigidly apply something that was written in 1916 in the midst of a world war, the First World War, and say these set of conditions apply exactly to what I'm seeing today. Things do, you know, history does rhyme. There's echoes of it. There's definitely pieces of it that are still fundamental to updated, revised version. But I think it's very important that we do update and revise things, right? So I think we'll often hear people taking like Lenin's five concepts or five key portions of his definition, which is, again, the concentration of production and capital into the hands of monopolists, merger of banking and industrial capital to create financial capital in the financial oligarchy, export of capital, taking preeminence over the export of commodities, formation of international monopolist associations such as cartels and trusts, and then the territorial division of the world being complete and thus war being inevitable as these capitalist powers who have divided the world continue to seek to expand, right? So a lot of that does still have relevance. But again, we don't live in a situation where there are a handful of Western imperialist nations of roughly or equally powerful, right? That doesn't exist anymore because in the post-World War II era, the U.S. essentially made clients of the entire West, militarily occupying most of Europe and integrating them into a new financial and military order based on the hegemony of the dollar. Fast forward, and the Soviet Union is illegally dissolved and overthrown, and we don't have that global counter to U.S. imperialism. So we enter into this era, essentially, of unipolar imperialism, because, again, the U.S. controls, I mean, the U.S. has established these institutions, which essentially serve the interests, first and foremost, of the U.S. ruling class, but, again, it has beholden the, you know, Western Europe to its will as well, I think, at that point in time is a fair way to say it. And I think that as we're looking at the situation on the geopolitical level play out on the world stage right now, I mean, this becomes very obvious, especially when we see how Germany refuses to stand even up for its own interests with respect to the Russia-Ukraine war, you know? So that's kind of the era that we're living in. So the U.S. ruling class basically sits at the center of a global empire, which is run in its interests and at the expense of nations the world over. So, I mean, do you have anything to add to that? That's a very brief summary, but.
Yeah, thanks for that summary. And thanks for also sort of, I think those 5-point definition of imperialism is still important. It's still
absolutely
relevant. But like anything, as Marxist-Leninists, right, we have to sort of update, revise. I think one of the most notable features as the Soviet Union's overthrown is that, right, this past decade is that the global, like the emergence of BRICS as a major sort of concentration of economies, right? Namely, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and then more countries are actually added on to that recently, right? So, and essentially, they are largely integrated into this world system, right? Because imperialism, like there's this tendency where people want to sort of apply statically this 5-point rule of Lenin that he formulated in 1916 as an attempt to sort of like a checkpoint for is this country, whether a particular country is imperialist or not. I think those 5 points were still defining like the general characteristics of global capitalism in its final monopoly stage, right? And at the time, there was also a clear demarcation between, like there were colonial and semi-colonial nations where the capitalist property relations had not fully developed yet, right? And then on the other side, there were major capitalist powers, which obviously had through many ways accumulated immense amounts of industrial and finance capital and then also divided, as you said, all the territory into spheres of influence. Now today, right, by contrast, the whole world, it's the capitalist property relations are dominant worldwide. And it's also under the direction of finance capital. So you can't really just sort of analyze modern imperialism in the 21st century by simply looking at, like in a static fashion, the economic features of any individual country in isolation, right? Because all countries in this global system, whether they're even capitalists or not, have to engage in some sort of a relation with one another, economic relation.
Yeah.
So instead, the right thing to look at it is to focus on a particular country's position in this global economic system and its relation to the group of countries that dominate, as you said, the world order and set its rules, which is mainly U.S., EU, and you can probably also sort of as an addition to that, you can add Japan to it, right? And when you look at in terms of inflow of investment, like foreign direct investment, OECD is right one organization which really represents the wealthiest sort of countries, right? Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. You can see that out of the OECD countries, 83% of all foreign direct investment outflows from these OECD countries. And it's actually increasing over years. Like it's increased by 20% since 2010. Meanwhile, the inflow of this foreign direct investment into OECD is 56%. So definitely, right, then you see that there's a delta of this overall, when you look at the OECD as an entity, capital in forms of direct investment out, like from OECD to out, right? There's a big delta. So then when you look at that, you realize that it's still those core imperialist nations led by US and then, you know, Germany and UK and Japan, which has that export of capital. Look at the also like the world's largest banks, right? And what those assets are, where they are located. You will see that like of the top 100 banks, 60% of the assets held in those top 100 banks are in OECD countries. There are only two countries outside the OECD that have like banks, like three banks in the largest 100. So again, right, this then goes to show that like these core imperialist powers led by US absolutely dominate the financial services and then using that also as a way to sort of impose their will and penetrate into markets. And of course, now here is where we can also talk about the military, because in case there is an independent entity, a nation state, like you can say Iran, Syria, or Libya was the case, if they try to, in whatever ideology they represent, if they try to pursue an independent policy, economic policy, or international policy, if all else fails for this core financial sort of power to penetrate into that market, right? The last resort is the war. U.S. military serves as the sort of the enforcement of that policy. That's also why when you look at like when you line the size of the U.S. I mean the militaries in the world, U.S. is like by a huge amount the largest, right? It's larger than I think right now. It's probably
the next eight combined, or eight to twelve, whatever.
I think it was at some point 12, but 10, 8, whatever, right? Countries combined. This includes Russia, China, Saudi Arabia, all these, you know, countries that do not, that have non-insignificant militaries. But imagine, sum all that up, that still doesn't by even a close margin, right, come up to the U.S. military's size.
Yeah.
$1 trillion budget a year. So that's ultimately serves as the force, right, to enforce the rules of this global imperialism.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so, but when you look at it this way, when you look at it as a global system, and when you look at it, imperialism as more of an all sort of not inclusive in the positive sense, right? All encompassing economic system, applying those five Lenin rules to countries dryly, and then calling all these other countries imperialists or sub-imperialists, whatever you want to, so they can come up with other sort of terms too, right? That just then blurs the lines in terms of this relativity, in terms of like who is the elephant in the room, right?
Yeah.
Then when you, once you start calling this and that imperialist, right, it becomes impossible to understand the relative position of force domination of one country versus the other, right? So then it's damaging, because especially for us that is fighting in the heart of the core imperialist center, right? We can't equate an elephant with another force that is much smaller in size.
No, that's all very well said. I mean, concretely, to give a sharp example of this, I think about U.S. relations versus Chinese relations in Africa. And we're going to be doing a forum here in Pittsburgh on Friday the 9th talking about U.S. imperialism in Africa. And I mean, one section that we have is going to talk about things like AFRICOM and the IMF. The IMF being like a financial institution that is dominated by the West, which imposes onerous terms of debt. I mentioned it earlier when we were talking about Ukraine, right? To actually force countries into cycles of austerity, force things like the privatization of state assets, force structural changes and adjustments to the government such that they are adopted into the neoliberal order rather than the, you know, rather than taking any kind of like independent economic people focused stake, right? And again, the IMF operates all over the world. There's a good dossier from Tricontinental, which kind of compiles its abuses in Africa specifically. But then they have, to back that up, to your point, they have AFRICOM, which we're not even sure of how many military sites there are, but there's at least 30 plus across the entire continent. And again, that is the military arm to back up that financial domination. And then we hear this a lot about China. Well, look at what China is doing in Africa. Again, to your point about rigidly applying these things, like trading in a global economy and cooperating for, you know, mutual benefit does not equal exporting capital in the sense that it hits the box and it makes you imperialist. In the world of U.S. imperialism, China doesn't even really come close. And I think the relations in Africa, Chow Collective has a really good dossier talking about the lie of Chinese debt trap diplomacy, especially on a comparative basis to what the U.S. and what Europe does. I mean, if you look at the Sahel region right now, which has historically been colonized by France, among others, many nations have their dollars denominated by the French dollar, the franc, right? And they had their own special currency set up called the CFA franc. I mean, that is a mechanism of financial domination under the auspices of the U.S. Western-dominated world order, right? And now you're seeing resistance to that.
Yeah, and I mean, two kind of examples come to my mind, really, when you mention Africa, and that for some reason, like the contrast between the way when the U.S. imperialism penetrates or gets hold of a nation's economy, how they sort of operate versus what China does. So, but before that, right, the AFRICOM, before they overthrew the Libyan government, wasn't even actually in Africa, right? They were stationed in Germany. And it was only like the Libyan government led by Colonel Gaddafi was on sort of a block to the U.S. being able to actually be present in Africa with boots on the ground. There was that, you know, African Union that Libya was leading in terms of putting together a different sort of an international organization that stood for sovereignty and independence. And only after Libya was overthrown that the AFRICOM actually moved from Germany to Africa. Another, I mean, so when Chinese come in and do deals in Africa, right, they generally, what do? They build infrastructure, they build roads, they build ports. How does the U.S. or a Western imperialist, what happens when they penetrate or they basically dominate another economy? I mean, NAFTA, what happened in Mexico is a good example, right? It's at the expense of the local economy when NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, was enforced on Mexico. That essentially was the death toll for the local Mexican agriculture, right? Mm-hmm. Which resulted in the loss of their livelihoods in the millions. And then naturally, right, this unemployment or the inability to sustain oneself due to this cutthroat neoliberal economy that was enforced on Mexico, or it could be anywhere else, Haiti and others, right? That's one of the also key reasons of immigration, that people end up having to actually immigrate, right? In the Mexico case, to the U.S. to be able to sort of sustain their livelihood.
Absolutely.
So that's yet another form of economic violence that how it's not always bombs or it's not even always sanctions, right? Even just this sort of cutthroat neoliberal policies that's enforced on other people's economies. How do you kind of define that violence when people lose their liveliness, when people lose their homes, when people have to basically be forced to move to some other country in search of, employment, facing all sorts of racism, detention, right? All this sort of disgusting racist, anti-immigrant policies. That's also part of the U.S.-dominated imperialist economy's violence, right? Enforced on peoples. That's another form of oppression.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So again, I think that's just a conversation on why we center the U.S. and Europe as kind of the epicenter of this current world system that we're living in right now and who's actually benefiting from it. Now, I think we want to start to look to wrap up here soon, but I think we'd be remiss if we didn't at least touch on this idea of multipolarity, because as we're talking about the changing world order, right, the rise of the BRICS, you mentioned the BRICS earlier, right, the rise of China, the rise of Russia, this term multipolarity gets thrown out, right? And then I think a lot of people will point to this as evidence to say, hey, look, see, like we can still rigidly apply this. The world's being divided up among, you know, so-called imperialist powers once again. And I think we need to push back on that a little bit, in that this growth of other poles, centers of mass, are a response to U.S. domination, U.S. European colonialism and imperialism, such that people can actually build formations to actually enshrine sovereignty. I mean, you see there's talk of like new forms of currency that may came up to facilitate this, more cooperation. Doesn't seem to be as much of like an ideological grouping, but just nations that have come together to say, hey, like we're trying to develop on our own terms and we want to work together to help facilitate that. We'll see where it goes. I think the point I want to make is that despite everything I just said, you know, and while there are a lot of positive developments within that, I mean, multipolarity from an ideological perspective is clearly not the end all be all or the desired endpoint, as if that could be a thing anyway, because we live in a world that's constantly changing. History never stops. But again, like this isn't like what we advocate for as like the endpoint of it. I think we have to look at it as like, hey, this is a historical fact. It makes a lot of sense given the history and the systems that we've already talked about. But I think the most we can hope for out of that is that we believe that it will open up the space for real determination in people's movements when, again, this system of U.S. and European domination is ultimately broken down. So in that sense, I look at it as a positive development. But again, like multipolar is so broad. I mean, you could have, you know, multiple poles of like fascist governments. So multipolarity in and of itself is not what we want to see. But I think it's just, again, it's just a historical fact that we have to contend with and orient ourselves within that reality.
Right. I mean, it's just clear that, right, Global South and also a lot of the workers who are suffering within the empire itself, right, is asking for an end or hoping for an end or organizing for an end to this U.S.-dominated unipolar world order. Now, if, you know, what comes out of it, this multipolarity, is simply sort of a conflict between unilateral initiatives, right? That's going to be a tough situation, right? Especially like obviously absent the notion or the presence of a force like the Soviet Union, right? That did keep, you know, albeit at its phases throughout its history, did might have different international orientations, but that did serve as a sort of a counterbalance to this imperialist camp. Absent that, right, it's to be seen. It's that's also why it's crucial that we organize and build a movement for both taking on this imperialist power that we're in the heart of, and also in principled solidarity in an anti-imperialist fashion with all the oppressed nations and oppressed peoples around the world. So that once this imperialist system is defeated, there could be a truly peaceful, and in that case, I guess, world that upholds all nations' right to exist peacefully, develop their programs, and coexist in peace. And needless to say, we as revolutionary socialists, for us, that system that we stand for is socialism, which is our ultimate goal in terms of replacing, overthrowing this capitalist system and bringing poor and oppressed people to power where they call the shots as the majority, unlike the current system, which it's the minority, wealthy elite, the banks and the corporations and the CEOs that call the shots, and it's their rule, not ours. It's their system, not ours.
Yeah. I mean, which is ultimately why I think this concept of revolutionary defeatism in the heart of the empire here is a good concept to orient ourselves towards, in that, to put it in very simple terms, at least the way I think about it, like if we're talking about the U.S. engaged in a conflict, proxy or otherwise, we should be rooting for their defeat in this. Again, if we're in agreement that the U.S. is the primary antagonist on the global stage right now within this world system, and for new space to open up for movements to grow, that needs to be gone. Then again, our position here should be orienting ourselves towards rooting for that defeat and being prepared to build something better out of it. Because again, history shows us that, you know, when those defeats happen, and they will, empires always fall, that is when there's space to open up for real revolutionary transformative change. And we need to be prepared to build the world we want out of it, because there's forces that are organizing against us on that front too.
Yep, it's a good way to frame it.
Well, I think we can leave it there, comrade. I mean, this was a pretty wide-ranging conversation. I enjoyed it. We touched on a lot of different aspects of what's going on in the globe right now, and hopefully tried to incorporate some of these theoretical concepts into a concrete analysis that hopefully our listeners can get behind. So thanks.
Well, thank you, Nick. It was a pleasure talking and having this, being on this program.
Definitely, always. Well, for the listeners out there, thank you so much for listening. Now more than ever, it is so important for you to go out and get organized and be part of the burgeoning anti-imperialist movement here that's centered around Palestine. It's important that this keeps going, though, once Palestine is free, because again, with U.S. imperialism still being present, there will be atrocities for profit for the few wrought all across the world. Again, ostensibly in our name. So it's very important for us to build the movement. Only we as people have the power to change history. But to do that, we need to be organized. So go out. We're out on the streets. Get involved with us. PSLPittsburgh@gmail.com. Follow the socials. Most importantly, come out and meet us and talk to us and get linked into the movement. So thank you all for listening. We'll see you out in the streets.
Thank you. Keep staying on the streets for Palestine. Make sure we have a huge task, right, and responsibility to do all we can to stop this genocide and to get ceasefire and to help in any shape or form we can to help liberate Palestine.
Absolutely. Thank you all.